From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early 1940s at a place known as Mittelwerk. To give you a visual, try this. Author Michael Chabon writes, quote, "All the secret headquarters of evil scientists hidden in volcanoes or disguised as islands, accessible by subterranean railways or retractable sphincters disguised as lakes, which afterward featured in James Bond movies and their imitators, all of them descend from the Mittelwerk." It was located in the Kohnstein, a hill just north of a town called Nordhausen. And there, in the midst of some of the worst fighting humankind has ever seen, the Germans created a secret V-2 rocket factory and used slave labor to build their weapons. That was the scene in which an American soldier, roughly 30 years old, rode into town searching for the man who created the very V-2 rocket being produced in that hillside. The American was trying to find Werner von Braun. Gripping stuff. So, is it true? Well, who knows? The one man who does is author Michael Chabon, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. His new book, Moonglow, blends elements of memoir and fiction. Its main character, well, one of them anyway, Mike Chabon, retells the stories he heard from the real main character, his grandfather, who shared them on his deathbed under the influence of powerful painkillers. The author has explained that this did happen back in 1989 in real life. Well, now Chabon, the character, learns about his family's forgotten history, the adventures his grandfather had in his life, and how the Chabon family was connected to important historical figures. As Chabon, the author, writes, quote, "In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to facts, except when facts refuse to conform with memory, narrative purpose, or the truth as I prefer to understand it," end quote. Well, Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize winner, is coming to Rochester this coming Sunday for the JCC Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival. And we expect to talk to him this hour. We're also joined in studio by Judy Blaustein, co-chair of the Jewish Book Festival, who is so excited for Sunday, are you not?
Very excited.
Well, and so we were just talking about, before the hour began, how producer Megan Mack and I had a chance to read this book, and we consider this one of the best books we've ever had to read for this program.
It's unbelievable.
And we read a lot of books. It's fabulous, Judy. What do you love about it? What do you love about Michael Chabon's work?
I love his literacy. I love his literary feel and how he describes things in his own way. Only his books could describe that.
The story, and we expect to find out from him, hopefully very soon, when he joins us. The story is apparently true, that in 1989, his grandfather was dying, and that through the help of painkillers, it was a bit of truth serum. Mm-hmm. And he ended up having a chance to speak to his grandfather and learn about all of these stories. So I think we've got Mike Chabon on the line. Michael Chabon on the line with us now. Are you there, Michael? How are you? I don't hear him. Well, maybe he is. We're going to see if we've got him in a second here. Once technology filters through, you're going to want to hear this hour, I promise. While we're making sure, let me ask Judy one more time here. The Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival is coming up, and it starts Sunday. So he's going to be here 7 p.m. Sunday night.
That's correct.
At the JCC for an opening event.
Yes.
You got big plans. What do you want people to know about Sunday night?
So we want them to know that they can still purchase tickets, although we have lots of people have signed up already, but we have lots more tickets left. They can do it on the website at rjbf.org, or they can telephone 461-2000. The event is at the JCC Hart Theater, and there's a dessert reception at the end and a book signing. So some people will get to actually speak with Michael.
And you also have a lot of ideas planned for beyond Michael Chabon's visit as well here.
That's correct.
What do you want people to know?
The book festival begins on November 5th, and it goes all the way through the 19th. So it's two full weeks of pretty interesting authors.
I think we've got Michael Chabon online with us now, though.
Okay.
Michael, are you there? We don't? We do. I think I hear him now. Michael, do you hear us? I heard something there. Anyway, we're going to try again. We're going to keep working on the technology part. Judy, what do you know about technology? Can you fix this?
I usually bring in friends that are really geeks and wonderful at technology.
I know nothing about technology. I mean, literally nothing. This is probably a user error. And I've got a Pulitzer Prize winner on the line. I can hear him getting ready for the program, and listeners just hang there. By the way, his book here has been acclaimed just about everywhere you look. I mean, I mentioned that we think this is one of the best books we've ever had to read for this program. The acclaim is phenomenal. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And when I was getting ready for this program, I was on a plane. I had this book. I'm sitting next to a guy who says, "Oh, what are you reading?" And we get to talking.
Right.
And he says, "I know Cavalier and Clay." I said, "Well, you're going to need to read this book here." Mungo. What does it mean to you to have a Pulitzer winner coming?
Oh, it's an exceptional opportunity for us. We are very, very excited to have Michael. And we're excited also because the director of Writers and Books, Kyle Semmel, is coming. And instead of just somebody speaking to us, although that would be exciting as well if Michael did just that, we are having a dialogue between Kyle and Michael, and that should be really interesting.
It should be interesting. I think we've got him now, and if anybody could have fixed the technology, it would have been Michael Chabon's grandfather, who seemed able to fix just about anything.
Right.
I think he's with us now. Michael, how are you? I don't know. I'm going to keep trying. They keep telling me we've got you, Michael. Maybe you're hearing me, maybe you're not. This is becoming very interesting radio. We know he's there. We've got a Pulitzer Prize winner on the other line, at the other end of this somewhere.
Right.
We're going to get our very best people on this. So for a moment, let's do this, Judy. Let's set aside Michael Chabon's book, because once we know we've got him, we're going to come back to that conversation and we'll spend the hour with him. What is topping the list for you beyond that? Because you've got this festival here, the JCC Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival. It starts this Sunday night with the event with Michael Chabon, but it runs for 2 weeks.
That's correct.
So what else is on the list for you that you do want people to know?
And people need to know that even though it starts officially at night, that Mark Shulman is coming, who is a really great teen novel author, and is bringing his novel Squirrel and speaking to kids. So that's in the afternoon preceding Michael Chabon's visit.
Okay.
Then Todd Moss, a local person, somebody who's been in Rochester.
And Todd's going to be on this program as well. Yep.
Okay. Who wrote The Shadow List and many other books, is going to come back. He's been with us before, and everybody's excited to have him back. That's on the 6th, which is the next night, Monday night. Then on the 10th, we have something that's happened for many years, and that's called the Fiction Panel Luncheon. We have three authors. This year, they're authors of mystery and suspense, and they speak together. And it's a luncheon so that we get to relax, have some food, and listen to these great authors. Ronald Balson, Julia Dahl, and Kukafka, Dania Kukafka, are the three authors that are coming at the fiction panel. Do we have more time?
We do. Keep going.
Okay. Rachel Cubby Adler is speaking with Holly Anderson, who is the Breast Cancer Coalition, the head of Breast Cancer Coalition, and Dr. Rachel Farkas, a local doctor here. She's writing about the memoir about her life, and it will be about genetic breast cancer, a pretty important subject. Then at 11:14 at 6 o'clock at Arundhati Country Club, we will have something that's a little bit different. It's called Beer and Books. It's on comedy, and it's it's Alan Zweibel who's coming, and he's actually a writer for Saturday Night Live.
Wow. So again, that's where and when?
That is at Arundhati Country Club. So most of these events are held right at the JCC. But on Wednesday night, the 14th, Beer and Books is being held at 7 o'clock p.m. Again, tickets can be had.
Okay.
Yes.
So give us a few more here.
Okay. Then we have another interesting event. It is on the 16th. It's by Leslie Bennett, who was an author who wrote a bio of Joan Rivers, a very dynamic person in her own right. So we're excited about that. We also have some local authors. We have Michael Dubkowski, who is a Hobart William Smith professor, coming in 11 o'clock on the 19th. And we have Alan Singer, also an RIT professor, who wrote a book about his father, Alan Singer, a renowned wildlife artist. So we've got lots of different kinds of authors.
And Judy, can you send people online so they can see the full schedule somewhere?
They can. So if they get online, they could get online with our website, rgbf.org.
We've got Michael Chabon now, Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of Moon Glow, this remarkable book. He's coming here Sunday night, 7 p.m. for the event at the JCC to help kick off the Lane Dworkin Jewish Book Festival. But he's on the line with us now. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
We've got you.
Been a little late.
Yes.
No, you know what I said, Michael? I said if anybody could fix this, it would be your grandfather.
If it was my grandfather, he would have been here an hour early.
Yes. So, listeners, if you're just joining us, let me go ahead and reset for you what we're doing this hour. We're not only talking about the Jewish Book Festival, but we're honored to have Michael Chabon, our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and he is the author of the new book, Moonglow. Now, it's fiction, but it is memoir-esque, and we're going to talk about, you know, where that blends together this hour. The book is, Michael, I said this at the outset, and I'll just say it to you again, and I don't say this to genuflect. It's one of the very finest books we've had to read for this program in years. Just couldn't have enjoyed it more. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. And can you tell our listeners, remind them, it kind of goes back to 1989, there is an element of truth here of something that happened in your own life. So why don't you set that stage for our listeners?
Well, yes. In 1989, my actual grandfather, my mother's father, who lived in Florida at the time, was retired and was a widower of a couple of years standing. And he took ill very suddenly, and the prognosis was not good. And my mother flew from her home, where she still lives in Oakland, California, to Florida to get him and bring him home to her house. And she put a hospital bed in one of the bedrooms in her house, and my grandfather spent the very brief remainder of his life there. And I was living in Seattle at the time. I came down to Oakland to see him because we knew he was going soon, and I spent some time with him, and mostly that consisted of my sitting next to his bed, talking and listening. And my grandfather was on very heavy-duty painkillers, pain medication at the time, and it had the effect of jarring his memory. Now, unlike the grandfather in my novel, who's very taciturn man, who's never really said, you know, five words together to anybody over most of the course of his life, my actual grandfather was a very loquacious fellow. He liked to tell stories, and he had told me all kinds of stories about his childhood and his memories and his family growing up and my mother's family when she was a child. And he had memories of me when I was little, and I thought I would have said I had heard all of his stories at this point. I was in my early to mid-20s. I was about 24 years old. But under the influence of this medication, all of these stories that I hadn't ever heard came out. Now, it was nothing at all even remotely earth-shattering or dramatic, nothing so sort of wild as the stories that are told by the grandfather in my novel, which is a novel and has a higher obligation to be entertaining than my actual grandfather did. Not that he wasn't entertaining, but what really struck me, what I never forgot from that experience, was just that sense of, wow, all of this was in there. And it had never come out until this moment under the influence of these, you know, these drugs. Not just loosened his tongue, but loosened his memory. So these things that it seemed as though he hadn't thought of them in decades, and suddenly they were there and he was telling them to me. And that, of course, made me wonder, what else is in there? What else is he not telling me? What are the stories I've never heard? And, you know, right about that age, in your mid-20s, tends to be, I think, the age when you first start really belatedly to realize that your grandparents were actually human beings. You know, that they had rich, complicated interior lives, and they had complicated professional and personal lives, and obviously, you know, they had romantic lives and sexual lives, and they were every bit the same kind of fully fledged human being that you are, and that you maybe give your credit to your parents for being, possibly. But you know, we tend to turn our grandparents into caricatures of themselves, and sometimes our grandparents will help us out in that regard, I have to say. But you know, I was starting to think, wow, this is a complicated, rich, emotionally complicated man. He was gone. And I never really had a chance to get the answers to all the many questions I might have had. But for my grandmother, it was already too late. She was gone. So this novel, in some ways, is my attempt to sort of invent a set of grandparents whom I can fully understand, whom I can try to explain, whose stories I am able to tell, because sadly, I really am not able to tell the actual stories of my real grandparents. I never bothered to ask.
Well, so let me ask you some questions that given what you told the New Yorker, I wonder if, you know, you'll be mildly
annoyed.
What
did I tell the New Yorker?
I wonder if you'll be mildly annoyed with this. What you said to the New Yorker was, you wrote, quote, you said, quote, I'll be honest, I just get interested in the story and start trying to tell it as well as I can. I just wrote the book. I don't have to interpret it too. So,
exactly.
Does that sound like you?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so here's why I asked.
Particularly at the beginning of a book tour. Well, yeah. Which I was at that time, I said that.
Here's why I ask, because this book, and it's there are a lot of layers to it. It's more than 400 pages, and I think if readers are like me, you're going to, within two pages, you'll be laughing out loud. And I mean, it takes a lot to get me to laugh out loud. That will happen a lot in this book. But there's also a lot that will really make you think about your own life, about your relationship with your family, about, you know, what is meaningful and what is not. And I'm somebody, Michael, who, whether I'm reading a book or listening to music, whether it's classical or a piece of punk rock or anything, I like to think about what the artist is trying to say to me. And then I read that quote from you in the New Yorker, and I thought, Michael doesn't want to be asked about that. He wants me to figure this out on my own. So,
yeah, well, I mean, I guess the question that I would least like to hear and be least willing to answer is not so much what should you get out of it or what do I want you to get out of it, but what does it all mean? I mean, to me, meaning is, you know, the book has definitely meaning for me and layers of interpretation. And I'm, you know, very, it's a combination of an intuitive process where things are finding their way, certain kinds of, let's say, systems of imagery, like images of the moon, for example, are working their way into the narrative in both without my noticing it. And that's kind of the magical part of writing is when you start to look back at, say, to take another example, a book of mine, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Like, I didn't know until I was about 2.5 years into working on that book that it was about escape in various forms. That I had, then I looked back and I saw, oh, I have this whole thing of Harry Houdini's in here, and I have this character who's escaping from Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia, and I have this idea of comic books, which are, you know, always being tarred with the brush of being escapist fantasy, and I seem to be writing about escape. And that was something that happened kind of unconsciously. Sometimes it's much more deliberate, and I'm thinking, well, this book is about this, and I have to, you know, somehow or other work imagery into this that will help me in making this book be more about that. But, you know, those are all for me to know, in a sense. It's what I need to know to write the book. But when it comes to the reader, it's not just, I'm not being cagey or coy. I don't want to get in the way of the relationship between the reader and the book, because as a reader, and I'm an avid reader, and I love to read, and when I pick up a book, I don't want the writer getting in the way of my relationship with, you know, with her book. I want to figure it out for myself and figure out what it means to me, and what it means to me doesn't have to bear any relationship ultimately to what it means to the author or what the author thinks it's going to mean to her readers.
All right, so that's totally fair enough, and I will not ask you what it all means, but I let me I'll flag a couple of things that really moved me though, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. One of them is, so your grandfather kind of goes in pursuit of this man named Wernher von Braun, and you had me going to Google often in this book to learn, which is a great thing. I love when I'm reading fiction, but I say, I want to learn more about the V2. I want to learn more about Mittelwerk. I want to learn about Nordhausen. And
me
you
too.
Had me,
I like that too. I
love that. And you had me doing that quite often. Well, Wernher von Braun is, you want to tell the audience real briefly who Wernher von Braun was? A real man, of course.
Sure. Wernher von Braun was the indisputably one of the greatest rocket engineers of all time. He was indisputably one of the earliest pioneers of rocketry back well before World War II began, even before the rise of Hitler to power. He was already a kind of amateur rocketeer. He then became the director of the Nazi secret rocket weapon program, the V-2 rocket. They had a couple of different programs, but he was in charge of the V-2. He successfully implemented, developed and implemented that V-2 so that it became a weapon of terror. It was not a particularly effective as a weapon in terms of the kinds of destruction and casualties that it could cause, but it was a reasonably effective weapon of terror. It never quite fulfilled the hopes of the Nazis in that regard, but it did cause lots of death and destruction. Even more troubling than the death and destruction caused by the explosions of the detonations of the warheads on the V-2 rockets in London and in Antwerp was the means by which the V-2 rockets were manufactured, which was a closely guarded secret, not just within the Nazi regime, but for decades thereafter in the United States and elsewhere. The V-2 rockets were manufactured by slave labor from concentration camps. Almost very few of the people working on the rockets were the kind what we tend to think of when we think of concentration camp victims. They weren't Jewish victims of Nazi genocide. They were prisoners from other kinds of concentration camps, many French prisoners, Polish prisoners, Russian prisoners, POWs, and so on, who were dragooned into service. They were kept in horrific conditions, and they were literally worked to death building these rockets. Wernher von Braun knew all of this. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew how the rockets were being manufactured. He knew the horrifying circumstances of the men who were building these rockets. He did nothing to ameliorate it whatsoever, and in fact, he made it worse for them. And then at the end of the war, he was captured. He allowed himself to be captured by the United States forces because he was terrified of being captured by the Soviet forces, who were racing from opposite directions across Germany, trying to scoop up as many German scientists and researchers and engineers as they possibly could. The U.S. got him. It got a fair quantity of his associates and fellow engineers and technicians, brought them over to the United States, rehabilitated them, wiped their records clean. I'm talking about the United States is doing all of this, declined to prosecute them for war crimes, and on the contrary, set them up in nice houses with nice cars and good jobs, and they worked the rest of their lives and went on, under the direction of Wernher von Braun, to create the Apollo program. So once again, all credit must be given to Wernher von Braun. Without von Braun, there is no Apollo landing on the moon. There is no Neil Armstrong, giant leap for mankind. That all happens because of this man who was indisputably a war criminal. And, growing up, and anybody who's my age, I'm 54, or if you're older than I am, you remember Wernher von Braun sort of in his heyday as a truly heroic figure. And his record had been whitewashed so thoroughly and had been concealed so effectively that he seemed like this genial, brilliant genius who appeared on the wonderful World of Disney next to Walt Disney, talking about how once we were done with the moon, we would go to Mars and the asteroid belt and then beyond out into the solar system and finally into interstellar space and carrying peace and enlightenment across the galaxy. He was that guy, and I admired him. I thought he was amazing. He was one of my sort of favorite public figures as a kid. I'd heard a little bit now and then about his Nazi past, but it was sort of almost a joking thing. It was Tom Lehrer having a silly song about him, or the character of Dr. Strangelove in the Stanley Kubrick film with the same title. I didn't realize, and most of us, I don't think, realize the extent of the horror at the Mittelwerk, the factory that was used to manufacture the rockets, and because it was all covered up, and it didn't really start to come out until the 70s, until after von Braun's death. The grandfather in my novel is there for it. He sees firsthand the vestiges of the Mittelwerk. He sees the stacked corpses of the dead workers. He sees the starving skeletal survivors, and he knows the extent of the betrayal that he feels by his own government when he realizes that this man is never going to pay the price for what he's done.
There is this there's this kind of evolution that your grandfather goes through of thinking of von Braun in this sort of romantic sense that this is the guy who, he didn't want to create a rocket to hurt people. He was, he was overcoming these scientific barriers, doing something beautiful, taking mankind to the stars, and only Only the evil of mankind has perverted this wonderful invention and used it to hurt people. And initially he's got this idea that I'm going to find von Braun and I'm going to tell him.
We're going to be friends.
I'm with you. I feel bad for you. He thinks about him as, I think at one point you said you envision him as this shy guy wearing a cardigan and, this poor guy, you know, which I love that description.
The grandfather himself is a dreamer of space. You know, his whole life, like von Braun, he has dreamed of space flight, of going to the moon. He's an advocate and partisan of rocketry and for peaceful purposes. And before he arrives at Nordhausen, where the Mittelwerk and the secret factory are located, he has this rather innocent, rather naive vision of the kind of man von Braun must be, which is then shattered by his, experience of what he sees at Nordhausen. And thereafter, his life really becomes darkened. A dark shadow falls over his soul, and he's bent on some variation of revenge or retribution, in a sense, almost for the rest of his life thereafter. And that transformation, that change, kind of does mark something that happened in me as I was writing this novel, as I was researching it. I had just sort of a light inkling of of the extent of von Braun's crimes, and I didn't even necessarily realize or know that they rose to the level of crimes until I began to do the research. And so that sort of progression and that mounting sense of outrage, and that sense of even more than that, what I think is more important that the grandfather feels, and it definitely echoes what I felt as I was researching, is less the sense of wanting to punish von Braun, although there is that desire, but it's more the sense of betrayal by the American government, that the American government was this willingly complicit, and more than just complicit, was actually directing the rehabilitation of Wernher von Braun for its own purposes. And yes, we did get to the moon thereby. And to me, I'm not in a position to condemn, and I'm not condemning the Apollo missions as being tainted by their having been directed by von Braun. That may well be true, but nonetheless, they happened. We went to the moon. It is a remarkable accomplishment. It is a remarkable achievement. To me, what's interesting ultimately is, that's the essence of humanity. That's the essence of what it means to be human, is that out of, that incredible accomplishments come out of horrific evil. And that horrific evil can come out of only the sort of noblest and best intentions, and especially when it comes to science, the implications of what we do as scientists are often far from clear to us as we are doing them. To me, it's the essence of everything about us, from, the discovery of fire, which is this incredible tool that keeps us warm and cooks our food and also can, kill us and burn our houses down, right up to today with the internet, which again is a kind of form of high-tech fire as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and I had kind of the same kind of conversion that your grandfather did about von Braun when he fully understood the depth of the man's crimes and how he changed from having a sympathetic point of view to something much darker. You had me thinking about something even broader. I mean, just the idea that mankind has done amazing things. I mean, amazing things. Just in the last 24 hours, I've been on airplanes in really rough weather, and I think, well, science says we're going to get there, and I have no idea how it's happening. I'm sitting in this plane, and it's going to get there somehow. It's amazing what we can do scientifically, but the von Braun story, to me, had me worried. Is it in our nature to pervert something that could be beautiful or a great achievement and use it for these, for ill-gotten gains, for pain, for suffering? Why do we do this, and is it inevitable that happens?
Well, I mean, certainly that's what most of our sort of mythology teaches us. Most of our sacred literature teaches us everything from the stories in Genesis to classical Greek mythology, classical Norse mythology. The story over and over again is of human ambition, human envy, jealousy, the desire for power, all of those things, taking what is originally kind of a blessing and finding some way of transforming it into a curse. I do think, You know, that's just human nature. It does work the other way, at least sometimes, however. And I guess in that is where you can put your hope, is that sometimes out of the worst circumstances, out of the lowest and most base human impulses, sometimes various kinds of beauty and nobility can also arrive, and sacrifice and you know, suffering that has a purpose.
My guest is Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new book is Moonglow, and he is coming to Rochester this coming Sunday, 7 p.m. Sunday night at the JCC for an event to help open their two-week-long Jewish Book Festival. And we'll make sure you get all the details on how to jump online, get details for the whole festival, but also if you want to go Sunday night and hear Michael Chabon, who is a writer who I would say, Michael, for me, I would just observationally, you have a way of writing phrases or describing something that seems effortless, but it makes me laugh out loud or remember a certain phrase without it having sort of this patina of trying too hard. And when it comes to your process, I saw in a PBS interview you did, it looks to me like you are almost lying down when you are working. Can you, and I would fall asleep. I would fall asleep. Can you describe that?
Yes. A regular chair just doesn't work for me. Desk and a chair. Physically, it makes my wrists hurt. I have terrible hand pain that came over me as a result of, ultimately, it turned out, sitting at a desk in the normal kind of setting, with a really good chair, just my hands, the position they were in. It got to the point where I actually had to stop writing for about a month. I wrote longhand and pencil on a pad just to give my wrists a break, which did not work at all for me, writing longhand. I cannot write even half as quickly as my thoughts proceed. And when I went back to work at the computer, it was with this new setup, which consists of me sitting in an Ames chair with my feet up and the keyboard in my lap and the monitor of my laptop, the screen of my laptop raised up to eye level. And so, yes, I can see how it might look like as if I were lying down. I am reclining, undoubtedly. And, you know, I work at night, and sometimes I'm not able to get as much sleep as I would like to. So I can be quite tired at about 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm lying, you know, sitting there in my Ames chair trying to get my work done. And I actually do nod off sometimes while I'm working. And I used to fight that for a long time. I might even go have a cup of coffee, even though it was, you know, the middle of the night, just to sort of combat the urge to sleep. And then I realized I didn't need to, and I will actually now let myself doze off. And sometimes I nap in the middle of the night for half hour, 45 minutes, even an hour once in a while. And when I wake up, I'm actually able to go for another 2 or 3 hours, and I can work till 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Amazing.
So
amazing.
I allow myself to nod off now.
Amazing stuff.
That's probably when I get some of my best sentences done, is when I'm actually fully asleep. No, I'm just kidding. I always wish that would happen.
Yeah,
like I'd wake up like the shoemaker
and
the elves.
Damn, I've got it.
I finished it.
Yeah. On the subject of Wernher von Braun, we've got Tom in Chile on the phone who wants to weigh in with a comment. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. First, welcome to Rochester. I look forward to reading your book and also seeing
Thank you.
When I was in at Brockport State University, we had Wernher von Braun come in and give a talk, and then we had dinner with him. And I just wondered if you had heard anything about his connection to the Rochester area in Brockport. Another professor came over, Dr. Preble came over with him. And so, back then we didn't know a lot about other than the NASA, and that's what we talked about mainly.
Right, of course. No, I mean, nor were you meant to. None of us was supposed to know any of that other stuff. And, you know, when von Braun was, when he was asked about it, and he was asked about it, and it wasn't like nobody knew. In fact, there were some survivors of the camp, the Dora camp, it was called, who subsequently wrote memoirs. And there was a French prisoner who survived and wrote a memoir that, when published in France, in which he directly not just fingered von Braun, but provided you know, accounts of Von Braun sort of doing it almost like a shape up, you know, at a union hall, where he would walk down the ranks of the prisoners and select the ones whose backgrounds seemed to suit them best for the kind of work he needed, because maybe they had some technical training, or maybe they had worked on engines or something like that. You know, it was known, and whenever he was asked about it, he would always say the same thing, which is a version of the idea that, look, I'm just a scientist. All I ever wanted to do was go to the moon, go out into space. You know, if I have made any mistakes, that mistake lay in simply foolishly putting my trust in this government who promised me that I would have the freedom to do the research I wanted to do. And yeah, they took it and they perverted it. And at that point I was in over my head, and they would have just, you know, shot me if I had stopped working on it. And I mean, that was his version when he was forced to give a version of what happened. That would be his version. And it was all false. And as I said, it turned out subsequently that he was a willing participant, and that he had voluntarily joined the Nazi party, and he wasn't dragooned into it by any means. But by all accounts, everything I read about him, he was a formidable figure. He was very much accustomed to being in charge, but by all accounts, he seems to have been a very genial, friendly, jovial man. He smiled easily. He laughed easily. He was relatively well-liked among his people who work for him. People really admired him. He didn't seem like some kind of a monster by any means, is my impression when you met him.
All right, let me grab Laura in Rochester also on the phone. Thank you, Tom. This is Laura in Rochester. Next, go ahead, Laura.
Hi. I think that the question that Von Braun raises really isn't whether humans are doomed to sort of use technology for bad, but what about us as humans makes us so willing to ignore all of the evil things that go into creating some of this technology, as long as in the end we can say, oh, well, it was beneficial for society, like the Apollo mm-hmm. program, because that's mm-hmm. what happened with him.
Right. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's ambiguity. It's, everything about technology is perfectly ambiguous, by which I mean, there are the light and the dark, the costs and the benefits over the long term seem to be able to be brought almost exactly within, you know, a 50-50 relationship to one another. And things that seem like incredible, let's look at something, for example, like antibiotics, which, you know, were such a miracle, have saved so many countless untold millions of lives, and changed the course of history. But now we are facing this situation where for various reasons that are very complicated, like so many things with technology, we may be faced with these superbugs that are untreatable by antibiotics of any kind that is currently known. And, that's an unforeseen consequence, and it comes many decades down the road. And we certainly, I don't think you can hold, say, like Sir Alexander Fleming responsible for having, discovered this remarkable kind of medication that has saved so many lives. And now it, possibly threatens to doom us all in some kind of massive super plague. That's not really his fault. But, I do think you could tell the history of the human race by telling the history of unforeseen consequences. And sometimes those unforeseen consequences, like I said, they're not always for evil. They're not always for ill. Sometimes things that seem like they're going to be disastrous or were invented in order to cause death and destruction or whatever it might be end up having a beneficial role to play, or end up turning into some unsuspected kind of blessing in disguise. That does happen too. That's just how we are.
This part of the book, Moonglow, the sections on Mittelwerk and Von Braun, strangely to me, bring up a comedic routine by Louis C.K. in which a construction called that he calls "Of Course, But Maybe," and it's not suitable for work listeners. But if you want to watch it, mm-hmm. he brings up the idea of some of the greatest human achievements were built on the backs of slavery. And the question is, why do we do this? I mean, some of the things that we've built couldn't have happened without throwing human death and suffering at it. And, you start asking really sort of interesting existential questions. So, I don't know, Michael, you've done a lot of interviews for Moonglow. We've gone in an interesting direction here. So look, our listeners have pushed us in this. And we are just scratching the surface, listeners. So if you're just joining us, Our guest, Michael Chabon, is the author of the new book, Moonglow. It is a wonderful piece of fiction, but it has a seed of truth, or at least some semblance of truth, because in 1989, Michael's own grandfather was dying, and he sat with him, and as his grandfather recounted some stories that Michael had never heard before. And the character in the book, who is his grandfather, never named, by the way, just his grandfather, does the same. He goes from someone who is very terse to someone who is willing to spill a lot of fascinating stories about his life, and they form the basis for these fictional memoirs that tell a lot of really interesting stories. I want to ask you, Michael, about a section that made me sad, or at least willing to kind of think about how I spend my day, or why am I spending so much time on Twitter, or what the hell are we doing with our lives? Your grandfather at one point talks about taking stock of things, and I want to quote from the book. There's a section where you're talking to your grandfather, and he says, "I'm ashamed," and you say, "Grandpa," and he says, "I'm disappointed in myself, in my life, all my life, everything I tried, I only got halfway there. You try to take advantage of the time you have, that's what they tell you to do, but when you're old, you look back and you see all you did with all that time is wasted. All you have is a story of things you never started or couldn't finish, things you fought with all your heart to build that didn't last, or fought with all your heart to get rid of, and they're still around. I'm ashamed of myself," end quote. Mm-hmm. That's tough, I don't know if it matters, but I'm curious to know if your grandfather did express a sentiment like that. And I don't want to ask what you want the reader to take, but I want to express to you that did make me think, I spent way too much time on Twitter today. I just want you to know.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to start. Yeah. I really don't know. I mean, I think my grandfather, the answer to that question, the honest answer is I don't know. And it's because I don't know, and because in a sense I can't answer that question. As well as I knew my grandfather, of all my family outside of, you know, the family I was immediately born into, he was unquestionably the one I was closest to. After my parents divorced, we lived close to my grandparents. My grandfather became very much a father figure for me. My actual father having moved away. I saw more of my grandfather in my middle to late teen years than I did of my father. I knew him well. He knew me. We loved each other. We were quite close, about as close as a grandfather and grandson could be. And I can't answer that question. I don't know what my grandfather thought when he looked back at his life. I have no idea. And it's that ignorance, it's that inability to answer that question, to even really honestly, I mean, I could make something up, and I did, and it's the novel. To honestly answer that question, I can't.
But is there a part of you there? I mean, do you look at your own work?
And is absolutely. To me, that statement you just read is much more something. If I don't feel it all the time, if I don't necessarily feel that way every day, maybe I don't even feel that way so often, but I can easily imagine feeling that way. And there are times looking back at my life and projecting myself into my own future, I can imagine looking back at my life and seeing it that way very easily. And in many ways, it is such a common question. This novel does take the form of a memoir. Not only is it very understandable for a reader to wonder, well, how much of this is true? How much of, was your grandfather like this? Was your grandmother? We haven't even talked about the grandmother yet, but
I know.
Was your grandmother like this? I understand those questions. Not only do I understand them, but I actually invite them. I mean, that was sort of, in a way, the whole point of trying to write in the form of a memoir was to engender that sense of both belief and uncertainty in the reader's mind. But the true answer is really, in many ways, this grandfather in this novel is much more of a self-portrait than he is any kind of a portrait of my actual grandfather. The grandfather and I have much more in common than the grandfather in my book has with my actual grandfather.
Well, I guess I read that passage and I can relate in many, many ways. I mean, certainly it's easy to feel like at the end of a year or a month or a week or whatever we want to look back on and feel like, well, what have I gotten done here? But you've won a Pulitzer Prize. And I've read interviews with you in which you describe yourself as really kind of soaking up the few, I don't know how many bad reviews that you get out there. I see very little in the way of bad reviews of your work, but I've read that you say you kind of soak up the bad and they last in your memory a lot longer than the praise. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think that's true for all of us, reviews or otherwise. How many compliments can you remember that somebody gave you when you were 12 years old? Right. But how many insults, persecutions, how many criticisms can you remember that people gave you when you were 12 years old? You know, those are the things that stick in memory. Again, that's just human nature. I think there's even scientific evidence to show that we are wired, our brains are constructed in such a way that we retain negative memories much more easily than we retain positive memories. That's an evolutionary advantage, I suppose. It's what tells you, like, don't go into that thicket again. There are bees there. So, you know, that is how we're constructed. We're constructed to remember the negative and the positive makes a less enduring impression. So, when it comes to criticism in the form of book reviews, it's really, really hard to shake off a word of criticism, a critical line in a review, even if the whole review is, everything else in the review is very complimentary. If there's one sentence that's a kind of a however, it's only the however. Last, that's all you remember. And I know I'm not unique in that regard. I remember my wife and I had a friend, a writer named Amanda Davis, who sadly died very young, a good 14 years ago now. But her first novel was published just before she died. And I remember there was this just glowing review in Vogue magazine of her novel. And it ended with something like, this is an example of a first-rate, if not perfect, novel or something like that. And she was obsessed with the words, if not. What does it mean, if not perfect? Like, are they saying, in fact, it is perfect? Or are they saying it's not perfect in some way? And what don't they like about it? That's just how we are. And, I think all writers are that way, but not all of them will admit to it, certainly.
The thicket of bees you described, by the way, is internet comment sections, which are just to be avoided.
Those are just a perfect example. But how many of us have not, had that perverse impulse? Even if the comments aren't about us personally, let's say they're comments about a political candidate we support, or an issue that we're in favor of, or whatever, a celebrity we admire, and then you're looking at the comments and you have that kind of personal investment, and you see the horrifying things people are saying. That gets to you in a way that seeing someone say, "I like it also," or "I think it's good," will never. You don't get anything like the same boost from that you get a kind of horrible negative feeling from reading some kind of criticism.
But here I thought a Pulitzer would sort of inoculate you from that kind of stuff.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I guess not. We've got to just...
I mean, it, you know, let's... I don't lose sleep over these kind of things.
Right.
It's a human... I can console myself after I have the initial, after the crying is over. I can console myself in various ways with various things, my beautiful family and my fact that I get to write the books I want to write and I get to spend my time doing what I love doing most in the world. There are all kinds of ways I can console myself, but that doesn't drive the negative out of my memory by any means.
Well, I've just got a couple minutes left with Michael Chabon, and so if you'll indulge me, I just want to ask you a little bit about your thoughts on process, and because as I mentioned, I think I love the way that you structure some, whether it's an idea or just, I think you're a phenomenal writer, and I have a real appreciation for this because the writing is colorful and interesting without ever getting purple. And that's not always easy to pull off. And I can tell...
That's very kind of you. Not everyone would agree with that statement, so I appreciate it.
Well, they haven't a right to be wrong. I mean, it's a free country. But in the first six pages alone, I flagged a couple of things I actually laughed out loud with. And so I'm just going to read these two real quick, and I just want to ask you one question, then I'll let you go.
Okay.
Your grandfather is getting dismissed from a job at Feathercombs here, and he doesn't does not take the news well.
No, he does not.
He goes in fact, to murder the president of the company. So the news just didn't go well. And
no.
He's
been having a bad week, it has to be said. By the time he gets fired, he's had a bad week.
So he marches in there, his face flushed with blood. You write that he looked sunburned, and an eyewitness told the news, "I never saw anyone so angry." And so I love this line. "For his part, the president of Feathercombs was astonished to discover that he had approved the firing of a maniac." I love that line so much. And then you at the end of that chapter, you describe, you said, "I did not say then or at any point until he sank into the cloud for good that he had told me very little about his life. I had yet to hear about the attack on the president of Feathercombs, Inc., so I could not point out to him that I sensed a motif of defenestration beginning to emerge in his autobiography." And the reason Michael writes that is because his grandfather, a younger man, would throw kittens out the window to see what would happen.
Well, just one. He threw one
just
kitten.
Just one. Yeah. Those just are two once. Lines that I laughed out loud with. And my last question for you is this. Do those flow out of you almost automatically, or do you, certain lines get more consideration and more sort of an artful touch to that you get in?
You know, it's hard to say. I guess I would say typically the humorous lines, the asides or whatever, the humorous constructions, the attempts at humor. Those tend to emerge unexpectedly and organically and kind of completely, and I might even be so surprised by their sudden appearance that I laugh myself while I start to feel something funny is coming even before I'm quite sure what the line is. I can feel there's a gag essentially coming, and then it comes and I write it down and I move on. When that doesn't happen, and the lines I labor over the longest trying to get a laugh, and just now just speaking specifically of the humorous parts, humorous sentences or whatever it might be, observations, the ones that I struggle with, the ones that I, I know this is funny if I can just figure out the right way of saying it, those tend to get cut. Maybe in a subsequent edit, I realize, I labored over that too long.
Michael, I think great literature is a gift to the world, and you've given us another wonderful gift with Moonglow, his latest novel. And we're thrilled to have Michael Chabon. So coming up here, what's the website for the Jewish Book Festival? Our listeners can check it all out.
The website is rjbf.org. Telephone 461-2000. Ask for tickets at the main desk.
rjbf.org. And it starts on Sunday night, 7 p.m. Michael Chabon at the JCC. Thank you for being here. Have a great festival.
Evan, thank you so much.
And Michael.
Thank you, Michael. We're excited to have you.
Absolute honor. Wonderful honor to have a Pulitzer Prize winner there. That's Michael Chabon. I'm Evan Dawson. Rob Braden, the engineer. Audrey Sample, intern. Megan Mack, producer. Have a lovely afternoon. We're back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.